Hey everyone, welcome back to the Contractor Revolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy. How far away are your workers really from being replaced by AI? Well, in today's episode, we're going to unpack a different perspective on how the contracting industry should actually prepare for the AI revolution. Today's guest, Qasim Aslam, has built and exited multiple multi-million dollar companies and now dedicates his time to helping business owners and their teams take control of AI before it takes control of them. And in his opinion, this doesn't mean to automate everything. It actually means to double down on humanity in every possible opportunity. If you want to future-proof your business and stay on the right side of AI, this one's for you. Now, let's get into it with Qasim. You're listening to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy, where we systemize contracting businesses for growth. Keep listening to learn how the world's top contractors scale their companies, build killer teams, and make more while working less. Qasim, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Danny, thanks for having me, buddy. Appreciate you.
I am stoked to talk a lot, actually, with you. We've prepped a little session on AI and how to integrate it into the business. I've also got some other things that, should we have time, I would like to get into about your personal life. So let's just start with this. You've worked quite a bit in this AI revolution that we've had the last few years. You've been involved in implementing this into other businesses and how they can essentially use AI in their day-to-day operations. There was something you said when I was watching you earlier. You said, scalable things won't be relevant. Be in the business of things that won't scale. And I thought that was awesome. I was like, "What? Like, can you expand on that? Explain what you mean by that?"
Yeah, it's not that that which scales is not valuable. It is. The problem is you have to divorce value from monetization opportunity. Anything that scales in a pre-AI world, anything that scales is a huge opportunity, right? It's an opportunity to make money because then you can be behind that which scales and you benefit from the leverage. In a post-AI world, anything that scales becomes ubiquitously available to everybody and stops being something you can bill for. And so this really weird entrepreneurial obsession we all have to seek out that which scales, it's like seeking out your own forced obsolescence. The new pattern of opportunity recognition needs to be finding the things in your business that do not scale. Because if it scales, think of it as a paved road. Like, a paved road is great if you own a driving service until you have self-driving cars. Now suddenly paved roads mean all the self-driving cars can go down those paved roads because those are easy to map. And so if you have a driving service, what you want to do is you want to go get yourself a four-wheeler and find all the places that you can deliver that aren't paved and that Waymo can't map. And now you can go, you know, whatever, over the tundra or through the swamp or wherever it is that you want to go, because the machines can't do that yet. And they'll be able to someday. That's the scary part, right? But seeking that which does not scale needs to be the new entrepreneurial endeavor, which is hysterical to me because, like, you get Ben Hardy, who I really love, by the way. He's one of my best friend's best friend. But you get guys like that launching things like, you know, scale.com, I think is what he just rolled out, or my good friend Ryan Dice with Scalable. And I'm not here to lob grenades at my friends, but I do think from a logical perspective, it's like, don't race into, you know, the meteor that's coming for us. Like, go find, carve out the opportunity to continue to be relevant in this productive endeavor. And that's by looking for the things that don't scale.
So what's so interesting, the reason that comment caught me more than anything is because Breakthrough Academy and all of our members work in the contracting space. And I always hear this analogy of, like, the plumber. It's like, it's the last thing to go on the map. Just perspective on this, perspective on the contracting space. Are we good? Are we, like, in for a wild ride as well? Just maybe 5 years later, like, where do you think we're heading with all this?
Yeah, well, keep in mind, I'm the dumbest human you're going to listen to all day, and I've only ever lost money in all markets and all prognostic endeavors. So please just temper
sure
my advice
resume
against the idea that I'm, you know what I mean? Like, do not know what I'm talking about. That said, I have thought about this more than any human I know. I own an incubator that's, I basically roam the United States trying to buy businesses with some of my friends, and I'm aiming at things like septic companies, grease trap cleaning companies, concrete repair. So I think that the trades have more staying power than digital businesses do. However, what we're seeing, and I'll use plumbing specifically because you mentioned plumbing, what we're seeing from a plumbing perspective is the beginning of the commoditization of the skill set. And so some of the more adept organizations, especially those that are backed by private equity, are doing really brilliant things. A tenured veteran plumber is an expensive resource, probably worth $250,000 a year, really. If you want to get somebody who can show up in residential or industrial and really know what's going on, that's an expensive resource. Now, what's interesting about that person is, let's say that it takes 3 hours from start to finish to attend to a high-end issue. And high-end, I just mean a complex issue. That 3 hours really only needs about 10 to 20 minutes of that veteran's time. It's diagnosis and prescription, right? It's like all business things. It's identifying the problem, knowing where to look, knowing where the pain might be, finding out what the issue is, and then saying, okay, this is what we need to do. And then the remainder of the 2.5 hours or more is the grunt work. So what they're doing, which should A, blow everybody's mind, and then B, terrify everybody, is they're strapping these kids who know literally, Danny, nothing, with cameras. And the kids go into Mom Pa Kettle's house, or they go into the warehouse, or they go into the office building, and they say, hey, I'm here to attend to your plumbing issues. And then you got, you know, a seasoned veteran, Roger Jr., whose dad, Roger Sr., was also a plumber and knows everything there's to know about plumbing. And he's sitting in an air-conditioned room, comfortably
co-piloting
behind a computer. And for 10 to 15 or 20 minutes, he tells the kid, all right, lift the flap, move the nozzle, crank the wheel, try this, try that. Ah, I know exactly what this is. You're going to do this. And he's doing that with 10, 15, 20 kids who could be across the globe. The organization I know that's doing this right now is actually limited to a regional area. But the thing that's even more interesting than that, right? So now you have a hub and spoke system and you think to yourself like, oh, okay, that's efficient, but you know, it's an increased degree of efficiency. Here's what they're really doing. Their end game isn't the increased degree of efficiency of Roger Jr. sitting in the air conditioned room and maximizing the value of his time. They're recording every single thing that he does, every question he asks, the decision engine, if this, then that, except when, and they're recording it for what reason? To allow AI to distill the knowledge that Roger Jr. has, because that's really the repository, right? That's the lexicon of knowledge that you would want access to. And it's geo-specific. So there's a massive difference. I own property in Fargo, North Dakota. I also own property in South Carolina. Way different worlds when you talk about plumbing or roofing or HVAC, right? It's all different. Well, if you and I were to sit down and build a knowledge base for that, it would take us the rest of our lives and we'd never get it done. Mm-hmm. But AI can do it, and just listening to Roger Jr. and I bet you, I don't know what, dude, 9 months? Double that. Say it's double, 18 months. And now all of a sudden Roger Jr. is superfluous to the process. And you got that young buck out there with AI on his shoulder saying, do this, do that, twist that, twist that. And then once robotics catches up, it's over. So, you know, does that sound like Chicken Little? Yeah. And is it about where we are? Yeah. I think we've all got a decade, dude. I think we have a decade to make as much money as is humanly possible. And then it's universal basic income for all, you know, like, and that's just, it just happens to be, you know, that actually might not be the worst thing that happens to humanity, but I'll stop talking because I realize I just kind of went off on you. I'm sorry.
It's amazing. What you just said, I think there's a whole bunch of people that are writing notes right now because what you just said is not only highly relevant to what everybody's probably trying to figure out, which is I cannot hire good people. How do I get a better like leader in the field to be able to lead all these young bucks that don't know what they're doing? And I think you just solved it in like 3 minutes, which is unreal. Now,
well, that's not me. That's private equity. The private equity guys, if you want to know what to do, follow them. They're the smartest, most industrious, most evil humans in the world. They're satanic. Like they have no heart, no soul, but they all went to Ivy League schools and they all get paid $1 billion a minute. And they really do figure things out to a degree that feels unhuman. Mm-hmm. Like they're amazing, amazing people, and be very careful with them because I'm not fond of them at all, but you have to kind of give credit where credit's due. Like they crack the code on stuff like that. And you're like, wow, never in my life could I have solved that problem the way that they have.
Hey guys, quick question before we continue the episode. If you could get a custom roadmap for growing your business in 5 minutes, would it be worth your time? After tracking the growth of over 1,900 contracting businesses since 2015, we've put together a 5-minute quiz you can go take right now that draws on a massive pool of data. You'll get instant access to a personalized report that's going to tell you which one of the four phases of contractor growth you're actually in right now. How your company stacks up in the 6 core areas of business compared with industry benchmarks. And what to go do next, including customized resources, tools, and templates you'll have access to right away. No waiting around for an email or filling out a million separate forms. The link is in the description, so go check it out. Now, back to the episode. They're just approaching it from a brand new perspective, whereas things in the trades and contracting space have been done the same way for so long. That is a very fresh way to look at a very old problem.
Yeah.
You talk about this a little bit, and I'm curious to get your perspective on this, because private equity is buying a lot of companies right now, especially in the contracting space. And how does an owner adapt to this? Like, is small business screwed? Do we just give it up to the man? Do we fight? How do we adapt and stay relevant?
So the interesting thing about private equity, I built, for those that don't know, I built the number one ranked Google Ads agency in the world, which is not a small feat, because there's 100 billion Google Ads agencies. And what that meant was I spent $100 million of other people's money on an annual basis, and I saw thousands of clients, probably tens of thousands of different businesses from the inside out. I've never in my life, not one time, Danny, seen private equity come in, buy a company, and make it more efficient and more profitable, ever. It does not happen. Here's what private equity does. They come in, they buy a company, they squeeze it for everything it's possibly worth. They water down the soup. They boost profitability for a short period of time, and then they sew it together. They buy company A, company B, company C, and they sew them all together, and then they sell them for a higher multiple. So they're playing multiple arbitrage. It's a game of hot potato, and as long as you're not the one holding the hot potato when it explodes, that's how private equity makes money. I've never seen private equity make money by making a business better and more efficient. I've seen them make money by kind of installing the systems that we just talked about, which you might say like, well, okay, that's efficiency increase. It is, and it isn't. It is because it answers the question, how do we scale Roger Jr.'s time? But it isn't, because private equity does not care about employee retention, customer satisfaction, reviews, reputation, legacy, the things that actually really matter. So as a small business, you will see private equity eat your lunch, especially if it's new in your space. You know, they come into your geography and they start carpet bombing the ecosystem with money, and they just gobble up the customers live. But then 3, 6, 9, 12, 18 months from now, you see what we've always seen, which is very, very upset, unhappy people. And if you're willing to do the things that don't scale, for example, if a real human answers the phone, which you just think like, oh God, Kasim, come on, I'm so busy. Like, what? I don't have time to answer the phone. It's like, all right, dude. But imagine what happens if you do. You know, like if a real human answers the phone, and forgive me for, dude, I own a staffing agency out of Latin America, so I'm about to say something that I think is going to piss some people off. But imagine this for a minute, Danny. A real person answers the phone and I can understand them. Mm-hmm. They speak a language that I understand in an accent that's accessible to me. I didn't say no accent, but an accent that's accessible to me. And that's where you have to be a little strategic, right? Like my father's South Asian. He's from Pakistan. If I put my father on the phone with my Kansas City dwelling Uncle Dave Carraway, Lieutenant Colonel in the Air Force, retired, my Uncle Dave does not like talking to Syed Aslam because he can't understand him, and the Asian accent is inaccessible. Whereas if Uncle Dave talks to my buddy out of Colombia, that could be his neighbor. So you start to make decisions like that. You start to do the things that aren't scalable. Answer the phone. Go to the potluck. Sponsor the soccer team. Have a get together. You know what I mean? Like, do the pound the pavement. Shake hands. Kiss babies. Do the things that are relevant to humanity, because the only value proposition you have in the business world is the collection of things that AI, robotics, systems, and computers cannot do. If a computer can do it, you lose. 1,000 times out of 1,000, you lose, because you can't afford the mechanisms that these trillion-dollar companies can afford. The only level of analysis upon which you win are the things that the computers cannot do. Answer the phone, follow up, send a handwritten thank you note, remember their kid's name. You know what I mean? Like all this stuff that's non-scalable. That's why I'm so annoyed at the word scale. I only want a business that scales. All right, good luck with that. Best of luck, moron. This whole Tim Ferriss 4-hour work week dream, it was a thing for the 25 years that we had the internet sans AI. Now, anything that AI can do is something you can no longer bill for. So I think that there's a huge opportunity for businesses. And this is where I'll get real touchy-feely with you, dude. But I believe it with everything inside of me. So we're just going to go here, and you can edit as much of this out or not even air this episode.
We'll keep you on. Dude, don't worry.
You got to love people. Like, imagine that. Imagine, like, showing up. And I feel that. I've got the Elsons. Greg Elson is my home painter. He was my property inspector when I bought property in Phoenix. And then he started a painting business, Desert Dragon Painting. And here I am on a podcast talking about him. Because who loves their painter so much that they talk about their house painter? But if I need anything painted, I go straight to the Elsons. You know what I mean? Like, there are people, there are vendors, there are organizations out there that you couldn't pay me to leave. And they're not private equity backed. And it's not because of their AI. And it's not because of their systems or their processes or their automation. It's because they've treated me in a way that makes me feel like they care and I now care about them. And that's where small business, there's four things you can, any business can sell. There's only four. There's products, programs, processes, people. Products, commodities. Programs, commodities. Processes, commoditizable.
People.
People are the only thing. They're the only thing we have. It's all we've got. It's the only value proposition. So find extraordinary people, empower extraordinary people, and then let people love people. And dude, if you do that, your business will never, ever, 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 ever have a problem. Ever, never, ever. Even in the post-AI revolution. Now, can that survive long-term? I don't know, dude.
We're going to find out.
Because now we're going to end up with our children's children who maybe prefer talking to robots than they prefer talking to people. But I think it buys you that, you know, 10, 20-year epoch that we're talking about before we all reach the event horizon.
And I do think contracting will be near the end of that epoch. Like, I think it'll last a little longer than the average, if not be one of the final ones.
Yeah.
How, like, so this is going to happen to society. We're all going to go through it together. This industry, I think, is a little insulated. Do we just ignore AI? Or are there things, are there opportunities?
No.
Yeah, this is what I'm saying. So where's the balance between making this very human-led, very heart-led, very people-centered, and still utilizing the tools that are available to us? Where do we find that balance, especially today? Because, I mean, next year might be totally different. But from what you see today, what are the opportunities with AI, and what are the things to steer clear of?
I think AI needs to be bottom-up, not top-down. So the example I'll offer you is, it's an example I use often. Imagine for a moment the 1930s fat cat sitting on the mezzanine of the manufacturing plant in the middle of Detroit, Michigan, right? Heavy set guy, cigar, looking down at the peons. And he looks at, he's got 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 assembly lines running at the same time. And he looks at assembly line number 3 and he goes, automate that. And then, you know, just rubber stamp, automate that whole damn thing start to finish. That's what we're doing with AI right now. And it's a ubiquitous truth. I know because I own companies that do tech enablement. I own techstack.com with some partners. I own Architects. I own AI-enabled EA organization. Like, I've seen this over and over and over again where people are like, quick, hit it with the AI hammer. I'll give you an example. A friend of mine had it's a massive organization. He does, you know, $50 million a year net to the bottom. Like, he does bank. It's all based off of a call center. And the call center is an ultra high-end call center that is his primary acquisition tool. Well, he gets seduced by some AI, who knows what's it, fancy smancy salesman that he met at a resort party mastermind thing, does a trial. The AI beats his call center by, I don't know what percentage, it wasn't significant, but the cost was was basically nothing, yeah. Right? Compared to this huge labor force. So he does this trial for 30 days, gets enamored with this tool, fires these people, these cultivated for well over a decade, and for 180 days is minting money. And then on day 181, there's this precipitous cliff and it just falls off. And then when he goes back and does the autopsy, because he's a smart guy, he's the one that identifies, he goes, that was the pipeline that my humans had created that AI was just eating through. These people had met a person, been nurtured by a person, made the decision with the person. So when the AI system took over, it was like, all right, I'm already going to do this thing. When he ate through his pipeline, it killed it. You can't be the fat cat saying replace assembly line number 3. Instead, what needs to happen is you need to align your incentives with your employees and the person working on the assembly line, who's incidentally, going back to the plumber analogy, his dad worked on the assembly line and his dad works on the assembly line. And the reason that's relevant is because they know this better than you will ever know it, could ever know it, will ever know it, period. And they, on the assembly line, there's 30 people on this one assembly line, and each person has 5 different tasks. And that person gets to look at his tasks and say, okay, AI cannot do task 1. I know because I've tried, and it doesn't have the ability to assess the intake, the material coming in to make sure that it's appropriate. So I have to do task number 1. It can do task number 2, but not as well as I do. But God, does it just outpace me on task number 3. And then task number 4, I'm going to keep an eye on. Task number 5, I need to do again. So task number 3, boss, we're going to use AI for task number 3. And now all of a sudden what happens? His productivity goes up by 20% or more. And you're like, wow, this guy just got empowered. He's now a superhuman on the assembly line. And then maybe it eats task number 5 and maybe it starts to encroach on task number 2 and so on and so forth. But that's bottom up. But that guy's not going to do that if he sees Fat Cat on the mezzanine just salivating, chomping at the bit, waiting to cut his payroll, right?
Yeah.
So the incentive, and this is a weird place to be too for employers and employees, the time for money trade feels
old.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, how about the number of jobs you get done?
Yeah.
How about the number of studs you can put in the ground? How about the, like, let's you and I find a way to work it so that the more productive you are, the more money I make and the more money you make. And that's great. And we bill the customer that way and you bill me that way. And now you've put these very industrious, very intelligent people in a position to want to figure out where on their five task list AI really, really cracks the code. And if you can do that, that's the bottom up. That's the penetration and the permeation. That's allowing AI to come in on a granular level.
What you're describing too is the ideal state for the transition of humanity working. Do you know what I'm saying? Because yeah. it allows the average person
symbiotic.
Yeah, to have a benefit from all of this, which to the other conversation we were just having with not even just private equity, let's call it big business. It's the opposite, and it's all about capitalization to the top. And it's looking at more of a, you said symbiotic, more of a like everybody wins strategy to help do this. I do wonder if small business, I think what you just said is amazing. And I think for small business, it's a lot simpler to implement. Is this something you've seen in other businesses? Is this something we encourage? Like, how do we get this out to the people to do this right? Like, what's a good example of this for a contractor to take some advantage of this?
So this gets very self-interested, Danny. So feel free to just play whack-a-mole with me too. I'm not trying to pitch. And you asked a question and I have an answer.
Sure.
I own an agency that staffs executive assistants with very busy entrepreneurs. And I call them AI-enabled EAs. And the idea is that your EA knows the usual suspects in the AI world. Not all of them, you know what I mean? But like the top 20, let's say. And maybe even that's excessive. And then they're sitting there looking over your shoulder, helping you manage your calendar or manage your inbox or do project management or do outreach or do whatever it is that you do, right? They're basically your right-hand person. And they're the ones that come in and say, hey, Danny, you should use this there. Because the thing is that's not your highest and best use. How on earth could it be? You and I were talking earlier about like the busier you get, the harder it is to pay attention to stuff. Dude, that's the entrepreneurial mind. We're not the technicians and the engineers that should run around sewing this shit together. Instead, what we should have is an adept human that's exposed to the system and allows us to play the Venn diagram game that would need to be played in order to kind of bridge those gaps. And I do think, stereotypically speaking, that person is probably a little younger. I think that person's a little younger, and it doesn't need to be one of my EAs. What you could do is you can go get that pothead nephew who lives in your grandma's basement, who is probably the smartest person in your family, but is just misunderstood, and everybody's like, oh, he's lazy. No, he's not lazy. He's uninspired. And you get somebody like that, and you say, hey, follow me around. Follow me around and just watch. And it sounds silly until you realize that's how all innovation is done and all innovation has ever been done ever. Jeff Hoffman, who's one of the co-founders of Priceline, I'm pretty sure he's a literal billionaire by now. I got the chance to hang out with him a little bit at an event. And he talked about info sponging and the miracle that happens when somebody from a completely irrelevant industry has the opportunity to be exposed to a new industry. It's called the corridor principle. Henry Ford learned what Henry Ford learned working on a sausage plant. Ray Kroc was selling, you know, snow cone makers or some. You know what I mean? Like it's when you take specialized knowledge in one place and then expose that specialized knowledge to a whole new realm where the amalgamation of information allows for something like the amplification of both. And I believe you can inseminate that. And you just take somebody who kind of naturally understands these new tools and technologies, which if you're under 25 years old, that's just what's happening in your life. And then you bring them in and you're like, follow me around, dude. You know, like artificially inseminate this incubator model and give this person the opportunity and then get the hell off your high horse. You know, this is the way it's always been done. You know what I mean? Like, listen to somebody who goes, you know what, if we did that in this way, that actually might be a little more efficient, and try it.
Yeah, what I find for even on my team is that everyone's so busy doing what they do, asking them to go and find new solutions for how they do it, even if they're willing to, it's just not a good use of their time, or the perception of their time. It doesn't seem like a good use of their time, so that it's hard to motivate them to do it. Where I've seen the biggest traction is actually in one of the new roles we hired. It happens to be a CTO, so that's convenient, but he's working on stuff that has never existed in our business before. And he's actually right now creating a data pool, and it's a completely fresh idea and a completely fresh department, and it's moving faster than I've ever seen. And it's that one area, and it helps that he's a CTO, but it's that one area that we're seeing the most innovation in our organization right now. And it's something that's never existed before versus something that it always has, and we're trying to do change management on. So
yeah. So, well, two things. One's a challenge and a friendly one, but just out of curiosity, the people that we're talking about that aren't necessarily innovating the way that you want them to, are they paid by time or are they paid by output?
They're paid on salary.
So I would, and salary really is just a fancier way to pay time. Somebody for their time. it's worth, and when I did this at Solutions 8, it was extraordinary, dude. I started paying people a percentage of the invoice. Mm-hmm. And the average media buyer had 15 to 20 clients, depending on the size of the client. When I started paying people by the invoice, when I sold my business, the Pareto distribution, it's why we call our agency Pareto Talent. I had one person who managed 40% of my revenue in a business that sold for eight figures. Like, you find your peak performers will be like, oh, because everybody's going to gamify the system. And if the game is, I make this much money for this much time, when you said that's not a good use of their time, well, you're right. Yeah. But if the game becomes, I make this much money for this completed task, this output, this, and by the way, I'm also not good at this. This is such a tectonic shift in the way that we do business. And I still have most of my businesses are people are paid on salary. But where I do figure out this kind of, you know, this Pavlovian prompt response payment mechanism where I can bill by the output and I can pay by the output, holy crap. It's crazy to see how industrious people get. All of a sudden, you're like, wow, you really, I didn't know you had that in you. And it's just human nature. The other thing that I think entrepreneurs sell short is we don't realize the entrepreneurial spirit of the employee. Douglas Brackman wrote a book that I think is required reading for everybody that talks about the epigenetic phenomena that is entrepreneurship. You mentioned dopamine before mm-hmm. we started rolling.
Yeah.
And he talked about how entrepreneurs experience dopamine, serotonin, and norepinephrine in some varying, you know, up-down cocktail, which I think is the same chemical cocktail that is love. But we experience it in pursuit of a goal. And it's only 5% of the population. It's 1 out of 20 that experiences it in pursuit of the goal. 95% of the population experiences it upon completion of the goal. That's the employee. The entrepreneur brain does not understand the employee brain. And so for us, the way that we would be incentivized or we would think about, like, this is the thing that would juice me, jazz me, fire me up, it doesn't work for them. They're like watermills, dude. They need like consistency and regularity and authorship and honor. And for us, it's like, I don't care who wrote it. We just want to win. And it's like, no, they actually want to put their name on some shit. And so I think learning to understand employees and then understanding employee incentivization will put us in a position of being able to really maximize their output. That's maybe the thing I'm most excited about studying right now. I'm not good at it, but I'm getting better. And the better I get, the more productive my entities get.
It's a key to a big problem, a big locked door that we've all been wondering about, which is what happens in 10 years from now when all companies optimize their ability to run without people. And what you're speaking to is empower your people to make great money and have great lives with you as we build this thing together. And it's,
yeah, Sean Putty calls it the K-shaped economy. So what he said, I really like this a lot. He said that if you look at the letter K, the base of the K is just today. And starting today, what's going to happen is the downward trending leg of the K is 80% of all businesses and all people will fall to absolute zero. They're superfluous to the economic endeavor. Go home, watch Netflix, which we will probably nationalize, by the way, and just stay there and we'll pay you to stay home and eat. And we'll be able to do that because we'll have massive deflationary events. Like everything's going to get so cheap, it's going to blow all of our minds. The upward trending leg of the K is 20% of people and businesses that will be so productive, it will be impossible to hyperbolize. You can't even begin to articulate the potential for output. We will outrun all needs across every level of analysis and simply be in business because we were the best. So it becomes a hierarchical structure where the only functional entity is the one that's at the top of the hierarchy. So the game we're playing is be the best. Go be the best. And if you can go be the best, which by the way, God forgive me for saying, isn't hard, dude. Everybody's trying to be the most mediocre. That's the game of business that we're playing. Everybody's trying to be the most mediocre. Whoever can be the most mediocre, which is what we're taught. We're taught to be, if you read any business book off the shelf, we're taught to be the most mediocre. That's why we have minimums and quotas. If you even look at our language and the way that we like structure things, it's hysterical because if you really zoom out and you're like, wow, we're trying to be the most mediocre. Excellence is not built into the fabric of entrepreneurship unless you get somebody who's absolutely insane. And everybody talks about how insane they are. Elon Musk, Steve Jobs. And then they're like, no, we're going to be the best. And then you look at what happens to the best. There's not even a second option. You know what I mean? So everybody's fighting to be mediocre. When you decide, we did this at Solutions 8. We decided we're going to be the best Google Ads agency in the world. And Danny, it wasn't hard. I've never run a Google Ads campaign myself end to end in my life. I wouldn't know how to, but I found the best. That's all you need to do. Find the people that are committed to be the best. Make that the vision to be the best. And then actually don't just make it lip service, you know, the values on our wall type of thing. That's all garbage. Go be the best. Be the best plumber. Be the best contractor. Be the best journeyman carpenter. And in this world that we're in, you'll become the upward trending leg of the K. You'll be the one that's like, oh, that's our guy or gal. That's the one.
Can I ask you something? We talked about it right at the very beginning, and I actually want to come back to this because I think there's some nuggets here. So you had talked about this concept of the best plumber, the best, most experienced human teaching all these young guys on the field how to go and do their job by just basically being in their ear or whatever it is with cameras on them, and then storing that data to be used later for AI. Can we speak a little bit about that? Because I feel like there's a massive opportunity in that even for small businesses to be creating, I guess you would call it like a data pool of all the best practices to be able to enable their people to the next step. Can you speak to this a little bit?
Yeah, it scares me because it's a bell curve. So, and again, everything that I think is just, if you ever want to make money, Danny, buy a stock, tell me what stock it is, and then I'll buy it. Or no, short a stock and tell me what stock it is and I'll buy it. And God will see that I buy it and then the stock will crash. Okay. The point being, like my crystal ball is broken. And just logically thinking this through, here's what happens. I think that the businesses that work towards that type of model get more and more and more and more and more and more and more productive and more valuable until they reach an apex. And I think the apex happens when, and people throw terms around like AGI, or even without the term, even just something like robotics, you reach this apex where you've created the value repository that's so valuable, we actually don't need you anymore.
Uh-huh.
And so now, can you put a moat around that repository? And I think the answer is yes for a lot of businesses. It would be in plumbing, it would be in carpentry, it would be in stonemasons, right? You can put a moat around it and you can sell it, but that's a one-time liquidity event for one entity. Or let's say that, you know, let's say that 100% of the knowledge is broken up into five different entities. So that's a one-time liquidity event for five entities, each of whom gets 20%. All of that to say, at a certain point, humanity sells its info to the machines, and then the machines have already articulated their ability to iterate. So I do think that's why I called it a bell curve. We get better, 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 more profitable, and then one day it just drops. And once the machines really can do everything, and we have machines that can clean skyscraper windows right now today.
Yep.
We have machines that can do office space,
we have janitorial machines that can do
services, including toilets, like mow lawns, deliver food. So I do believe all these people that say, oh, we're just going to do bigger, better jobs. We're just going to have something. That can't be true. They sold that to us in the Industrial Revolution when we outsourced manufacturing to emerging nations. They told everybody that Americans were going to upskill, and we did not. What happened, if you go Google what WTF happened in 1971, one, we were taken off the gold standard. Two, we doubled the labor force because women entered the labor force because of birth control. And then three, we lost all manufacturing jobs, which is why the amount of money that Americans have made not only has an increase, but actually adjusted for inflation has decreased year over year since the very beginning. We are going to find ourselves at an event horizon where there's nothing for you, me, or our children to do. Now, we will live in an economy and in a society that will produce so much value. The hope would be that the powers that be, and dude, I'm a rabid libertarian. The fact that universal basic income is something that I'm talking about, I think is hysterical. But I see no other option. Yeah. Unless you want farmers with pitchforks just running around, you know, breaking into and rioting, what ends up happening is something like everybody paid to stay home. And my hope would be that there's something like the next renaissance. You know, like entrepreneurs, we're going to sit in a bathtub of gasoline lighting matches. We will not know what to do with ourselves. But artists, musicians, filmmakers, sculptors, athletes, people who like to do things for the sake of the thing themselves, I think it's going to be a whole era of humanity self-actualizing.
I think, yeah, I phrase it as hobbies. It's like, hey, what do you do for a hobby? Right? Like,
what are those?
Instead of what do you do for work? It's like, hey, what do you do for a hobby? It's like, I do this. And that'll become our fulfillment, right?
That'll be what we do, dude.
Yeah.
That'll be what we do. I hope either that or it ends up being like Wall-E with a bunch of fat people roaming around
dude,
on those floating chairs.
I think a lot of people think that.
Yeah.
Just with our big Slurpees.
I think AI is the best thing that happens to humanity in 100 years. I think in 50 years, it's bloodshed and turmoil. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a transition.
Dude, look at Peter Thiel. Did what? Went and bought an island. Mark Zuckerberg did what? Went and bought an island. The Cisco guy did what? Went and bought an island. Every human who has access to the information and the money is going and removing themselves the human endeavor for a little while. You know, like that should tell us something. There's, you know, and even on a smaller scale, all my friends that have money, they're all buying homesteads. Danny, all of them.
There's not even an exception to prove it, right?
You know what I mean? Everybody, I want a piece of land with high
fences.
There's
something instinctual about it, actually.
There really is, because we all kind of see and feel this thing And I don't, I don't think that this is like, you know, worldwide Holocaust or the collapse of civilization, but it is an unknown.
It is
an unknown that I think we're all just going to want to know how to attend to and attend with. So like I said, dude, we've got 10 years. I hope we've got 10 years. That actually feels a little optimistic, but hopefully we've got 10 years to make hay while the sun is shining and then right off into the sunset. And the thing that's crazy about it, dude, is it's the most potent opportunity climate I've ever seen in my entrepreneurial life.
Mm-hmm. And so, it's fast moving and you got to be conscious of it.
It's like the time horizon's the shortest, but the opportunity well is the deepest. It's like, I keep grabbing with both hands. I have 17 entities I have meaningful involvement in. I can't stop starting things because they're just, it's like, well, I can't not do that, you know? And so for people that want to walk around with their eyes open, and this is the worst part, this is where I lose all my listeners. If they're willing to do a little work, although, you know, your guys, contractors know what work is like, but the people I talk to, bro, these info marketers, they want to do nothing. And they're the only people in the world. It's so funny. They'll spend 12 hours a day trying to do nothing instead of 8 hours a day doing something. You know what I mean? Like it's the funniest form of laziness I've ever seen in my entire life. And I'm glad when I see them fail because I think they deserve it. I want them to succeed, but they need to go through that. It's like easy money is this, the short way is the long way. And the fast way, the shortcut is the longest way there. And the fastest way is what looks like the long way. Do you know what I mean? Yep. I'm saying that poorly.
I get it. Yeah. It's long-term pain or short-term pain for long-term gain versus long-term gain for short-term pain. It's just, it's a principle in life that's always been around. You know what? Yeah. I will say this. Yeah. Our industry works too hard. We have too many workaholics. We have too many people that don't know how to slow down and let go. And you come from, actually just, you were talking earlier, but it's like having people come in from outside and have a fresh perspective. I'd actually appreciate just talking to you today because it is quite unique in the way you're speaking. What advice would you have for those listening to a bunch of overworked, hardworking dudes who are in the trades? They still probably have probably 5 to 10 years before this industry shifts. What should we be focused on right now? What should we be doing? Where's the opportunity in this industry?
Dude, I don't think you need to, first of all, pioneers get shot, settlers prosper. Yeah. You do not need to be ahead of the curb. What you need to do is not be behind. You don't want to be the last gazelle in the herd because that's the one the lion gets, right? But you also don't necessarily need to be the first because that's the one the hunter gets. What I would recommend is there is 50, nay 150, nay 1500, but at least 50 things that you are neglecting right now that you know you should be doing. Don't go seek out the things that you don't know. Don't go learn AI. You don't need to do that. Is your website mobile responsive? Have you updated your NAP? Do you have a Google My Business profile? Do you actually collect reviews? Do you follow up with customers? Do you send thank you notes? There's 150 things that you've known you should do since you got into business that you haven't gotten around doing that, to be honest with you, there's nothing stopping you. And you're like, oh gosh, I'm so busy. I'm so, you know, I have to go do the work. No, don't do that. It's 5 hours. I've proven this. I have a free forever community I've built called 3X Freedom, where I teach people how to execute on frameworks in 5 hour increments. It's an hour of learning, 3 hours of doing, and an hour of iteration. And if you set aside 5 hours a month, you could do one really extraordinary important thing for your business. And you're like, I don't have 5 hours a month. Great. 5 hours a quarter, 5 hours a year. What I really think is a business owner should be spending 5 hours a day working on your business, not in your business. And your business would be worth, I swear to God, if you're doing $1 million gross rev, by next year, it'll be worth $3 million. If you're doing $3 million, it'll be worth $9 million. If you're doing $9 million, it'll be worth $30 million. If you spent 5 hours a day working on your business, but if you're just so star-spangled important to your business that you can't do that, I think you're an idiot. I think you're penny wise, pound foolish. And I think that you're not seeing the forest of the trees. Sorry if that got too aggressive.
Dude, it's perfect. I was just going to say, so literally in Breakthrough Academy, when we bring in members, one of the first things our assessment team looks for is, do you have 5 hours a week is what we go for. Do you have 5 hours a week to work on, it's literally 5 hours. To work on the business. And if we can't make that happen.
Well, it's a scientific truism, right? 5 hours for deep work. That's what you need.
It's not going to happen unless we can make that happen. That's like stage one. And then within that 5 hours a week, to your exact point, we have a little bit of space where every week we slowly make iterations. And it's the slow iterations over time that make all the impact. It's not the one big idea that you do on a Tuesday that suddenly changes the whole company. It's little things. Slow over time. There was something we talked about before we went live with you I really want to get into. And we touched on it just now with AI. Eventually, like you have done, people sell their businesses, they get acquired, or they move on. And you're going through this right now. And whether it's now or 10 years from now, when AI takes over the whole friggin' world, we are all going to have to find meaning in other things than our companies. Can you speak to your journey so far on this and just what you've learned?
Dude, it's been so hard. So I'll tell you this, the person who should be giving this advice is the person who's on the other side, right? Like you enter what is, there's an archetypal story of the knights of the Round Table who, looking for the Holy Grail, enter the forest where it's darkest to them, which means you have to face your worst fear. And then you go into the depths of the forest and it gets worse and it's worse and it's worse and it's worse. And then you come out the other side and you find the grail. I'm in the middle of the forest right now. So I'm giving you bad news from within, saying, oh God, somebody come help me. And I'm a welfare baby, dude. I was raised by a blind single mother on Social Security disability in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You know, my dad jumped ship. My mom lost her eyesight. And really, in a lot of ways, I was a trust fund baby, right? Because the United States Social Security Office did what? They fed me, they clothed me, they educated me, they housed me. I'm a pretty lucky guy. I was born on the right side of an arbitrary line, so I didn't starve to death. But money was traumatic. It was a traumatic experience to me to be poor. You know, my house was two blocks down from the projects, got the beat out of me all the time. And I thought money solves everything. And I spent 20 years of my life working 8 hours a week. And then I sold my business for an 8-figure sum of money. So I'm a decamillionaire, which is a fun thing to say. And dude, I'm not going to tell you money's not great. Money's awesome. But it's not what I thought it was going to be. Money makes me feel safe, which I really appreciate. Mm-hmm. I love feeling safe. I love knowing where my meal is going to come from. I love knowing that my children will never have to worry. But it's not it. There's only so many Mai Tais by the beach. And I remember listening to like the Tony Robbins types, you know, because I was so into that for a long time, saying like, oh, money's not going to make you happy. And I was so mad when I heard that. You know, in my mind, I'm like, screw you. You have no idea what you're talking about. And here I am on the other end of it saying, not only did the money not make me happy, the money exposed all of the unhappiness I'd been hiding and running away from and ignoring while I was working. And so you have to be prepared to go all the way back and address all your demons and all your doubts and all your fears and all your traumas. And it's this crazy cold bath you get thrown into. And I think the thing to be ready for is to begin articulating a purpose that you feel is greater than yourself. Like, and I use languaging that may not appeal to everybody, but I'm gonna use it anyway because it's what appeals to me. Why does God want you here? You're a splinter of the divine. You're an individual manifestation of that which is most holy. And I don't care what religious book you read, they all say the same thing. They all say that. You know, it's Christ consciousness, if you want to use that languaging. And even an atheist would have to look at this ultra-intelligent chimpanzee floating around on a flying rock, solving problems and sending to space, and just think, you know, there feels like there's more to you than just what meets the eye. And so I think that having those conversations now, you know, like Khalil Gibran says that work is love made visible. When you're working, I don't care what it is, if it's fixing a toilet or building a website, that's an articulation of love. So take that and make it not a metaphor. How is it that you actually expect to love the world, to love people, to inject love into whatever this fabric is that we have? And I can tell you, people don't like this conversation, especially people that are on their way. But you have to, if you don't have it now, I promise you, it's so much harder to have it after the fact.
Well, this is why I'm bringing it up, because I feel like even in this podcast, like, we do talk a lot about how to grow and scale your business and how to profit, be more profitable, and how to, you know, find more time away from the day to day. And I think it's important, because I think we need to cross that barrier. But if we don't at least sometimes talk about what happens afterwards, I have yet to meet a person who hasn't described exactly what you just described about loss of meaning when you lose your business, especially for those who have been entrepreneurs for a long time. Like, we wear it as like our skin, and we don't really know what to do when we don't have it on. And I've seen it as a pattern that I hope anyone listening right now just understands. Like, this is, out of everything we just talked about, this is probably the thing to store away, because you're not going to see this or hear this anywhere else, or not very often. And by the time you've made it, it's already too late, because you didn't do the prep work. And the reason I'm asking you is because I am thinking about this over the next 5-6 years, like, what does this look like? And how do I make sure I don't lose my meaning, me, along the way?
Yeah. Like I said, dude, I'm in the middle of the forest right now. I want to matter so bad. You know what I mean? Like, I want to give, and I want to do things that really make an impact, and I want to love on folks. And I want to feel like I was here for something that was more than just running Google ad campaigns. You know what I mean? And it's a strange thing to start at 40. I have friends. One of my best friends in the whole world, his name's Mike Sample. He's such an extraordinary human. He was the executive director of a major LA nonprofit. He's a Grammy shortlisted musician. And he's spent his entire life teaching children the arts. He's in India building arts education facilities for children. I'm helping him raise some money. And I look at him and I'm just so envious. I'm in awe. he built this facility in Ecuador. He got the largest bank in Ecuador to fund the whole thing. Everybody go Google Mike Sample, find him on LinkedIn, send him money. Cause all he does is just give it to kids. He just teaches children. But the thing is that I love about him that I'm so envious of is he knows why he's here. He knows music and kids. You know what I mean? Like music and kids. And I love kids, but I don't, you know what I mean? Like I don't have that thing that like,
yeah, it's not your journey.
It draws me out of bed in the morning that I just, or I do, and it's building businesses, but that's going away, Danny. We got 10 years, dude. You know what I mean? I have 17 businesses and I see that ending and I'm like, well, what's my music and kids? What's my thing? What's that thing that like is a spark inside of me that I can give to other people that feels eternal, you know? And God, do I want that.
But what was it when you were a kid? What was it in your 7, 8, 9, maybe 12 years old, maybe even 15 in high school? Like what was going on?
Dude, you know what? So I've been a hustler since I was 7. I always said I wanted to be a business owner.
Yeah.
You know, I was buying candy for 10 cents and selling for 25. Like I've just been, I have always just been, me and my little brother call it Stone Soup Hustler. Remember the Stone Soup story?
I do remember it actually. Yeah.
We're still, because we can take nothing and turn it into something. Stone Soup Hustlers. And without the hustle, and most kids from, you know, the wrong side of the tracks,
yeah,
they get that.
I've said nothing, so I have the exact same background as you. Not exactly, but I have a very similar background. And it was like, you know, I need to have a better life. And now you've created that. And you look back and you're like, I've been really just honestly running from that my entire life. And now I have to confront it. So,
well, we missed out on play. You know, one of the tragedies of a childhood that maybe isn't as, what would you call it, traditional as one would hope. It's not a Robert Frost poem. Is you said, like, what was it when you were a kid? And I think that's the exact right question. And I missed out on play. And so I think some of it, I'm in a group called Front Row Dads. It's the best thing I've ever done for myself. If you're a dad, you have to go join Front Row Dads right now. I'm not an affiliate, but it's extraordinary. There's 350 men that just want to be better fathers. And that's all we talk about and all we do. And we just went camping together, just a dozen of us. We split off into little groups. And we talk about play all the time because most of us missed out on play. And when you return to play, like Maria Montessori says, play is the work of children. And so I think that there's something there. Like what feels like play. My buddy Artem, he's a Front Row Dad. He's one of the smartest people I've ever known. Wildly successful. Built up this huge net worth at 40 at 30 and then retired to be a dad for 10 years. Hasn't worked in 10 years. And is violently more successful than I am. And he talks about how your real genius isn't the thing that you're best at. It's the thing that you're best at that not only doesn't cost you energy, that when you're doing increases your energy.
Yeah.
And he says, it's always going to feel like play.
And it's finding that. It's finding that outside of the business you've been operating for so long.
Yeah. What's play?
Yeah. Yeah. I think about the things I obsess about and what brings me happiness and joy and how much of those things actually used to be things like building a sandcastle, building a fort in the woods, building up my car when I was 16 years old and getting the new sub in there and then blowing it and then getting another one. Just like I could spend all night doing it and then wake up and just be like, oh, like that's all I've been doing. But I gave up all of that in pursuit of growing up and being an adult. And and I'm trying to think back to those things, and it's probably going to manifest in a different way as an adult, but it's like being aware of those are the types of things. A lot of it was in creation and building, right? There was a go-kart.
So that's
I built.
What I've landed on. I just defined the core values for my children. We did this really fun ceremony at this Twin Eagles thing, this wilderness adventure we went on. And at the end of it, we made a shelter and we ate food that we, burned on coals and found. Anyway, it was amazing. And then I gifted my children with these inscribed values, and it's chalice, and C is it's creation, honor, alchemy, love, integration, and sovereignty. But creation is first, because I've landed where you've landed. Like for me, I don't know what it means yet, but creation is the thing. Like no matter what I'm doing, I want to create something. And I think like I've creating business has really resonated with me, but when that is taken off of my slate, I want to create something.
It's also if you're a faith-based man, like it is inside of us. It's a part of who we were created after.
It's the closest we'll ever be to God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. God's the creator.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you want to, mirror the father, let's say, and that's what a father does. A father teaches his children how to, that's the patriarchal heritage. You follow your dad. It's the reason that on an archetypal level, regardless of whether or not you want to take it literally, Jesus was a carpenter.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously. You know what I mean? Like, what else could he have been? Because that's what needed to happen. That's how God passes down, you know, the lessons to, again, I'm speaking archetypally. I'm so afraid of the woke warriors, but I'm going to say his son. And then I'm going to get an angry email.
That's okay. We'll get some angry emails. It's okay. It's a good, you know what? It's regardless, the understanding of what you're talking about right now is something that I think a lot of people are going to need to face, regardless if they sell their business or in the next 10 years, everything changes. So anyway, thank you, man. Thank you for being a part of this conversation and getting into it the way you have. I know actually on that note, you have to go hang with your kiddos and pick them up from school.
Yeah,
so.
I got a little boy who's got soccer practice, so okay. I'm going to jet, but I appreciate having me on, Danny. Thank you.
Because that was awesome. Okay. I'll let you get back to it.
Appreciate it. See thank you, Juan.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our podcast, consider sharing this episode with another contractor that you think needs to hear it.